You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Abrupt Climate Change. A talk with Dr. Guy McPherson, Monday, August 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Waypost in Portland. Dr. Guy McPherson is a professor of conservation biology and an author. He'll present his synthesis of the current peer-reviewed research on Earth's recent phase of rapid warming. Again, that's Abrupt Climate Change. A talk with Dr. Guy McPherson, Monday, August 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Waypost, 3120 North Williams Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Yay! This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio. Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Wednesday, August 10th. The sale will be held in mid-August. Stay tuned for details. Please, no home recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KBOO. Consider adding KBOO to your will or add KBOO as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change, but recognizing KBOO along with your family and friends and your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KBOO to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact Becky Myers at 503-231-8032 or email development@kboo.org to notify us of your plans. And now, Rise Up with Sonali.
From Los Angeles, California, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, a new website connects Americans offering goods and services to one another under the banner of reparations. We'll speak with founder Natasha Marin, and investigative journalist Arun Gupta joins us to discuss his new report on how a financial company called Numi is ripping off poor people who are jailed. Plus, Kevin Zeiss lays to rest the persistent myth that Ralph Nader spoiled the 2000 election for Al Gore. Zeiss will apply his analysis to the 2016 election. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, a new website that connects Americans with one another to offer an exchange of goods and services is named for the politically charged term reparations. Founder Natasha Marin started the website as a way to address what she described to the Los Angeles Times as a way for white Americans to, quote, cash in your whiteness to help other people. On the website are offers that include airline miles, childcare, and running errands, and requests that include asking for help with moving. Overall, there are more offers than requests. Natasha Marin is a Seattle-based artist. She's the founder of the website reparations.me, and she now joins me on the program. Welcome to the show, Natasha.
Hi, Sonali.
So first, tell me how all of this started. As I mentioned, reparations is a politically charged term. However, of course, the movement for Black Lives recently adopted its policy platform. And one of those issues that it has taken on is the issue of reparations. When we think of reparations, we think of the historic debt that this country owes to African Americans. How do you define reparations for the purposes of this website?
Well, I define reparations the way the word is defined. The word has definitely been used in a political context, but the word itself is talking about repairing something that had been broken, healing something that had been wounded. You know, when you hear the word repair, you can hear that echoed in reparations. That's the essence of what the word means. And my project is about bringing about that kind of healing and repair in the present tense about what's happening right now.
And so, of course, we understand and know study after study shows us that people of color, in particular African Americans, often get denied all sorts of the kinds of, you know, rights and services that white Americans take for granted in terms of employment, education, opportunities that that are often not given to them because of implicit biases and just persistent racism. Is that the kind of thing that you're hoping to address, the kind of present day ongoing bias of our society against African Americans?
Yes, but the project, so when you go to reparations.me and you look at the about page, you can see what the project is about. And it usually, it surprises me a little bit how few people have actually taken the time to do that before they sort of react to this word reparations. The project is not about polarizing people. It's about connecting people. And many of the people who are making offerings are, in fact, people of color. And many of the people who are responding compassionately and doing what they can are people of color. People who identify as white, I ask that they not make requests because there are already plenty of platforms out there for that. But yeah, the project is, it's all people of color making requests and offerings, and people who identify as white can also make offerings as well.
And have you
so
found?
So it's not actually a binary situation. Mm.
So when you, obviously this project is very new, but have you found that there are, you know, or have you gotten a sense of the statistics of how many whites versus people of color are making offerings?
No, the project is very new. I think it's in its third week. So it'll be a month on the 15th of August. Wow. So it is a brand new project. I would say that it's kind of tied, like my feeling, because I, of course, all this data kind of passes through me. I haven't really stopped to do analytics because I'm too busy trying to facilitate connections between people making offerings and people making requests. But many people making offerings are people of color. Many people making offerings are people who identify as white. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is something that we often overlook. Whiteness in the Western Hemisphere as a concept is a relatively new one. That's why many people who troll the website have things to say like, well, what about me? My grandparents are Irish. What about me? My grandmother was Jewish. Well, yeah, the reason why you're saying what about me is because you realize how new your whiteness is. Whiteness is a construct created to oppress other people. Literally, we are actually all from Africa and we are all people of color. There's just some of us who have been claiming this privilege over others. And I think it's time for people to do something about what they see and feel happening around them. Mm-hmm. It's not right. It's not fair. And if you're still out there wondering, what is this privilege that I have? I don't even want to talk to those people. I think if you're smart enough to, you know, read, write, follow the news, do some research, think critically, you can figure it out on your own. And this is a voluntary project. Mm. No one is forcing anyone to do anything. But if you are the type of person who likes to actually be of use to other people, to your community, to your family, there are people in your community, there may be people in your family who have made requests for simple things like a ride to the airport, or can you come with me to buy a used car? Because leveraging your privilege is just that. It's recognizing what you have that could help other people.
Now, there are many websites, you know, localized websites around the country that might be similar in how they work, but they're under the framework of bartering, right? Under the framework of exchanging. So what your website is doing, I think, is very clearly set apart from those efforts, even if the technical website mechanics might be similar?
Yeah, I think I'm working more in a gift economy. I'm worried that we're getting to the point where just being a decent human being is considered charity. You don't get a cookie for being a decent human being, and I don't understand why that is so exceptional. If you're a human and you like being a human, you understand that we're social creatures. When someone in our immediate group is suffering, we should all feel that suffering, and we should all want to bring about some healing. That's what it means to be human.
Now, you brought up the issue of trolls. And of course, the fact that your website is called Reparations is likely what is attracting these trolls. And I found that the very creative way in which you've dealt with trolls is something that a lot of people could try to mimic, particularly people who challenge the status quo. It's very easy for the trolls to be rude online in a way that they would never be face to face with people. And women in particular are victimized by the kind of really nasty online harassment that often comes from men. What sort of trolling have you been subjected to? But most importantly, how have you dealt with it? How have you turned that around?
Well, I think you're right that in the most essential way, trolls are cowards. And trolls are cowards because I don't think they would say and do the things that they do in front of their grandparents, in front of their mother, in front of their roommates. This is a secretive, hate-filled way of communicating with people. And the Seattle Globalist covered this Facebook event page I started almost the same time as the Reparations Project, called Shrine of Asshats. If you go, it's a public event, so you can go to Facebook and put in your search bar Shrine of Asshats, and you will be able to see how this project is being trolled. A lot of people have this wonderful pastoral idea about us being in a post-racial society, and I'm sorry to burst your bubble, but we are not. We are not post-racial at all. There are people who have been threatening me, threatening my life, calling me an N-word, telling me I'm a monkey, I need to go back to Africa, simply because I am doing what I can do to bring about healing in my community. It's repugnant. I often wonder, like, could this person not be spending this amount of energy helping the people around them, actually doing something good for the people they care about? But no. People from Australia want to take time to, like, write an entire article just calling me an N-word.
Wow.
So what
happens now if somebody sends you a nasty message? How do you turn their message around to benefit your project?
Well, if they are foolish enough to send it from their legitimate email account, I screen print it and I share it in Shrine of Asshats. So do all the other moderators. So the first thing is you open yourself to being trolled when you troll me. See how you like it when a bunch of strangers call you a racist in your inbox, because that's probably what will happen. It's a public event, Shrine of Asshats. So that's the first thing. The second thing is there are many more people than trolls who hate trolls. And all of those people have been coming together. Doesn't matter what color they are, what background they are. If you are not down with KKK racism, then you can become a troll slayer. And it's very easy. Within a couple clicks on your cell phone or your laptop, you decide how many trolls you would like to slay. People have slain 1 to 2,000 trolls apiece. And you just make a donation. And for every donation, for every $1 donated, it goes to offset the cost of the emotional toll of dealing with these trolls. And as a side benefit, the trolls become fundraisers, as all the troll slaying fund goes to offset existing requests being made.
Well, I really, really loved hearing that and seeing that a very creative way to deal with what is really a global phenomenon now. Natasha, let's talk about the broader issue. This project has appeared and the work that you've done to make it happen has happened in a context where the country seems to be dealing for the first time in decades with racial injustice, as we see on the streets, not just in terms of police interactions with African Americans, but also in a systemic way. The notion that we live in a post-racial world is little bit by bit being undermined by video evidence that people are now able to gather of racist behavior and racist police violence. How important is that framework, particularly today, as this week we are hearing about the horrific story coming from Baltimore of the police killing of the young Black woman, Corinne Gaines?
Yeah, I spent this morning crying about that situation. I told your assistant, I was like, I was in my bathrobe when you guys called, because I just don't feel like I can even get out of bed today. It's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying to be a Black woman in a country with who is a mother and see that people are being hunted down and killed for little more than not having the correct tags on your car. You know, the story of Corinne Gaines goes a lot deeper than I think we're hearing about in mainstream media. This is a woman who said a month prior to her being gunned down in her home holding her child, they're going to kill me. She said that. She said, they're going to kill me. And anyone with access to the internet can look up videos from her, from her son. I saw videos of her son in the hospital today talking about what happened. He's 5 years old. You know, this, it's way past time for us to check in as human beings who care about each other. And the violence that is going on, this state-mandated violence that is going on, is despicable. And we need to do something about it. It is not okay.
Natasha, your project got its start partly on Facebook, which has become a really important tool. However, and we saw, for example, in the shooting death of Philando Castile, how his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, immediately and very bravely and thoughtfully started a Facebook live feed as the police were still there. However, when Corinne Gaines tried to post videos of what was happening, this five-hour standoff while she was in her own home, surrounded by police on the outside, the police contacted Facebook directly and Instagram, and Facebook owns Instagram, and asked them to disable her account so that she couldn't post the videos. And Facebook complied. Is this technology a double-edged sword, given that it's, of course, owned by wealthy elites?
I think Mark Zuckerberg needs to have a come to Jesus moment, you know, a quote unquote come to Jesus moment, because Facebook is an incredibly powerful tool. It could be used to bring people together. It could be used to help protect people. And I know since I started this project that I've reached out to many people at Facebook asking them why something can't be done about the death threats that I receive. And you know what happened to me? I got blocked from Facebook.
Wow.
To receive death threats.
Huh.
Yes. 24-hour, like, put in the naughty kids corner. You know? It's absolutely ridiculous. there should be people protecting us, not people attacking us. It's ridiculous. And I was really horrified to find out that the police, first of all, how did the police get to contact them directly? No one else can. If you sit down today and you try to contact somebody at Facebook, like to get anything done immediately, good luck to you. Good luck to you, because that's not going to happen. So, yeah, of course they needed to hide the evidence of what's really happening with this story. It's absolutely ridiculous. I'm sorry. I'm upset today. I'm very upset. I think there is no reason to shoot a woman in front of her child. Well, I don't think there's a reason. I don't care what she could have done. There's no reason for that. Who's going to make that up to her son? Right. What kind of reparations is he going to get for losing his mother?
Well, sorry. Well, Natasha, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck. You will post a link to your website from our site later today. Thanks so much. Natasha Marin is a Seattle-based artist and founder of the website reparations.me. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. When you are arrested and jailed, you expect to be deprived of your freedom, but not of the cash in your pocket. A new investigative report by our correspondent, Arun Gupta, for The Nation magazine has uncovered the insidious new practice of a growing number of county jails across the country of taking away people's cash and returning it to them in the form of debit cards that have fees attached. Gupta examined in particular a fast-growing California-based company called Numi Financial that won a contract with a Multnomah County Jail in Oregon. Jail authorities issued Numi debit cards to inmates after they were freed. Instead of the cash they expected to have in their pocket to help them catch a bus or a cab home, they're now faced with trying to use a debit card, often with poor instructions and no warning of the onerous fees attached to using the card and even to checking your balance. Gupta's investigation led him to the National Sheriff's Association conference, as well as to Tijuana, where he found a large number of deported migrants whose money had been returned to them in the form of these debit cards after they were arrested and deported. Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist. He's written for dozens of publications, including The Guardian, The Nation, and Salon. He writes regularly at Telesur English, and he was a founding editor of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. His article in The Nation magazine is entitled "The Financial Firm That Cornered the Market on Jails." He's also a correspondent for this program. Welcome back to the show, Arun.
Great to be back with you, Sonali.
So first, reading your story just drove me crazy with anger. Like, I couldn't believe this practice. It was infuriating to read that these things are happening. So tell us specifically about the one county jail that you focused your story on and the company Numi Financial that it has entered into a deal with. How did it all happen? How did it happen that instead of simply taking away someone's belongings, such as their clothing, phone, and cash, etc., and then handing it back to them after they're freed, now they're handed back everything minus the cash, plus a debit card. How did that even happen?
Well, first, the prison industrial complex is a major industry inside the United States. We're talking about something close in the range of $100 billion when you include all the various parts of it. And so the millions of people who get locked up annually are seen as sources of revenue. The way this came into being is over the last few decades, there's been this move to increasingly put costs on the the prisoners and their families. So if you're in jail or prison now, you have to pay for communication, such as a phone call or emails for commissary. The food is really terrible and just kind of meets the bare caloric intake. So a lot of people get money to buy basically junk food in the jails, for health care, for clothing, and all of these require accounts, and often multiple and different types of account. And the companies that then provide these services skim money at every level in terms of, like, say if you want to send $20 to, you have a son in jail and you want to send $20 to him, it could cost you $6 plus processing fees just to send them $20. So this is how these debit cards came in, because a lot of inmates end up leaving jail. They had some money on their account, or they came when they were arrested. You know, you're just arrested with whatever you have on your person, and people may have a few dollars, or they could have a few thousand dollars in cash. And previously, the way it's worked for decades is, say you are arrested for drunk driving, you're held in the holding cell overnight, you had $100 on you, you're released in the morning. Typically, you would get that money back either as cash or as checks. Now, this did require, obviously, a bookkeeping system on part of the jail. So companies started to figure out that, like, there was a market in digitizing and automating all this, creating essentially going to jail and prison systems and say, hey, we'll provide you with a debit card system. You take the person's money, you enter it in this cash counting machine, it records it with their jail ID and name, and then when they're released, you just enter their name and it'll spit out a debit card. So there's actually nothing, I think, wrong with this. It makes sense on a certain level.
But let me stop you there. Why does it make sense? I mean, if you take my phone and my clothes and there's cash in there, why can't that cash be stored in the exact, you know, just recorded how much it is and then stored in the exact same place as the rest of my belongings and returned to me, especially if I'm a poor person, may not have a bank account and may need to have that cash on hand to buy a bus fare once I'm, you know, dumped outside the jail?
Well, I should say it makes sense if they have a way to retrieve the cash very easily. And it also makes sense, really, for people who have, say, like $20 or more, because, right, you can't get less than $20. The reason it makes sense is because there's a lot of graft and just errors within in the jail system. You know, you're going to, and this is, it was told to me directly by the vice president of NUMMI Financial. You know, it's just like people are putting their hand in the till, right? You know, we know this for a fact that there's a lot of...
But that could easily be happening even now with the debit card situation, right?
No, it's actually a lot harder. I mean, I don't want to defend it. Mm. What I am saying is there are problems, though, within the current system. Mm. You know, it's, and so, but the problem with the debit card system, which I want to focus on, is they what they do is they set up this maze of hard to avoid fees. So the NUMMI card, they have all sorts of different programs depending on which jail they contract with. You know, they offer them different programs, and they could have anywhere from 9 to 14 different types of fees. So you can get hit with like a fee just to check your balance, a fee for insufficient funds or declined transaction. If you go to an ATM, you're going to be charged by that third-party ATM, but then NUMMI Financial could charge you $2.95 or $3.95, you know. Then after a few days, usually a maintenance fee kicks in. And so what we found is that over 80% of people who get these cards end up paying some sort of fee. And 30% of them never even get a penny off their card. So what it is it's a way to basically just siphon money off the poorest people. Someone who's been released from jail has half the per capita income on average. So, you know, these tend to be people from the poorest segment of societies. And, you know, this was a long investigation. So we were looking into just the challenges that jail systems did have. And, you know, they would talk about that there are all these problems within the current management of it. So there's no perfect solution. solution. The Oregon State actually, what they do is they give, in the state prisons, they give prisoners, they give them a card also, but it's fee-free. And that actually kind of works the best. So there are different choices is what we're trying to point out that the jail systems can make across the country. But what they choose to do generally, the ones that have adopted these debit cards, and we found, identified 10 different companies that offer inmate debit cards, which is telling right there. You know, when you have so many different companies trying to get a slice of this action, and this includes some of the biggest banks in the world. This includes Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase. You know then there's a lot of money to be made in this area.
Right. They wouldn't be doing it if they weren't able to make money off of it. But are they then offering these county jails these services, saying that it's going to save the jail and the inmate money? That, of course, couldn't be true because they're not in the business of doing charity work, right? I'm sure Numi is making plenty of money.
Right, right. And you know, their vice president, Rick Delaney, I went to the National Sheriff's Association because I saw they were listed in as having an exhibit in the vendor hall. And I talked to him for about 20 minutes. And he's like, of course, you know, we're making money off the fees. He's like, you got to make a profit. He wasn't shy about that. You know, he gave me his whole sales pitch and was just like, this is great. You can get out of jail, go buy a cup of coffee, go, you know, get a shirt, you know, a meal, whatever. And though what we found in practice that this isn't true at all either. You know, I what I'm trying to point out, there is a way it could be done that would benefit released inmates. But you have to have a kind of a culture and a society that actually cares about, you know, people coming out of prison. And we have a society that treats prisoners and ex-prisoners as less than human.
Couldn't the same cards that prisons are issuing, some prisons that you mentioned in Portland are issuing to their prisoners, be also offered to people held in county jail? Isn't the business model of Numi Financial based on the fact that there's a much higher traffic of people coming in and out of jail?
Because
precisely. Right. So if they were in a institution, a correctional facility for a really long time, then that money is going to be sort of tied up sitting there waiting for the person to come out and use it and pay the fees.
Precisely. And that's what the Numi financial executive told me. It doesn't do us any good if they're sitting in prisons. We market to jails. Our model is based on turnover. And so there's approximately about 700,000 people who are released from state and federal prisons every year. The turnover in jails, and remember, this is just saying, you know, you could be arrested for public urination, disorderly conduct, all these minor offenses. And so there's very high turnover. There's 11.7 million people who are booked into and generally released or transferred every year. That's, you know, it varies obviously year to year. But so close to 12 million people a year who are booked into and then released or transferred. So this is a huge volume of people. Essentially what Numi Financial doing is they're looking at a Walmart model, right? They're trying to like basically get a hold of many jail systems as possible. And they, in fact, according to their own claims, they're issuing more than 600,000 cards a year. And we also talked to some of the leading national experts in the prepaid card industry. These inmate debit cards are considered a segment of the prepaid card industry. So this includes things like if, you know, you get a gift card for Applebee's or for iTunes or a corporate gift card or whatever. And one of the experts told us it looks like he had never heard of Numi, even though he's one of the nation's leading experts. And he said, this looks like one of the biggest prepaid card providers in the country. So it quietly went about becoming this kind of just massive player in the prepaid card industry with no oversight, no regulation. This industry exists because it slips through loopholes in consumer financial law. And it's just, you know, what people are telling us, this is just basically theft from people who need every bit of assistance that they can when they're getting out of jail.
Now, Arun, one of the most sort of disturbing parts of your investigative report on NUMMI Financial is how they are taking advantage of undocumented immigrants. Tell us about the story of the one immigrant who you followed who had just cashed in his check, his paycheck of over $2,000 when he was arrested. And then when he was deported, he was just simply given a card with that money on it.
Yeah. So, you know, there's still, a huge amount of deportations happening every year of people living inside the U.S. This isn't people who are caught on the border. And one basically typical method by which undocumented migrants are picked up is a minor traffic violation, right? Someone fails to yield at a stop sign, or they have a broken taillight. So they're then caught up in these county jail systems. And what we found is NUMMI Financial is in many counties in the Southwest, where you have a really high level of deportations. And we found this one individual, Alejandro, through the help of this migrant aid organization called No More Debts. He had $2,100 in his pocket. If you're undocumented, it's very hard to access like banking. He had done a roofing job with two other workers. They had done it for a week. They were paid $2,100, so it was $700 each. Picked up, put into a county jail. He had been, he had been convicted of a DWI like over 10 years earlier. And so he was put into deportation proceedings. So when he gets over the border in Nogales, he has this NUMMI card with $2,100 on it. But when folks are deported, they then encounter all these technological and cultural barriers. For instance, the card may not have yet been activated, and you have to call an 800 number, except 1-800 numbers don't work from Mexico. If you're having any difficulty and need customer service, if you're able to call customer service, NUMMI Financial and No More Debts documented this in quite a few instances, would not have any Spanish language operator on the line. And when the volunteers from No More Debts tried to assist the migrants, the operators would refuse to speak to them because they weren't the card holder. Also, one very simple thing appears to involve a huge amount of money. They're told that their PIN number is their birth day and month. Except in the U.S., we reverse it. We put the month first and then the day. So folks who are from Mexico will try to use the day, then the month. They keep trying to use it. They aren't able to access any cash. And we heard this numerous times. I went with an interpreter. We visited something like 9 different shelters over 2 days in Tijuana. And people were, men typically, they were like, I just threw the card away in frustration because I couldn't access any money.
And every time you try to access the money and the card is denied, it charges a fee, right?
Yeah, every time. And, so you could go to, you're supposed to be able to use it at a convenience store or a grocery store. Often it wouldn't work and you're charged a dollar or two every time. So we have these bank account statements where someone is charged like a $1.50 fee like 7 times in 10 minutes because in frustration they keep trying to buy something and it doesn't work. And meanwhile, and they have no idea they're losing all this money because they can't access their account. We found the case of an individual who he was arrested by the county, then sent to an ICE facility, and his card was activated when he was in, and he was then held in the ICE facility for 9 months, and he had $100 on it. One of the primary ways NUMMI Financial, and I should point out, it's NUMMI Financial and its underwriting bank are the ones who are making the money, and MasterCard also has gets money from this. So this involves, the complete complicity and activity by the financial industry. He had $100 on his card, and he was being charged $295 a week for maintenance fees. After 9 months, when he was finally deported to Mexico, there was no money left on his card. So it's just like on and on and on. There's all sorts of different ways. And so in Tijuana, we went to this one Casa de Migrantes sitting on the top of a hill overlooking the Tijuana River. And we talked to the administrator, and he said, we started seeing this card in 2014. And he said, we've seen hundreds. And I was like, hundreds? And he's like, yes, hundreds. And he said, maybe one in 10 get any money back. And he wasn't aware at all about the reversal of the birth date. His jaw opened when we told him about it. And he's like, this is the first time anyone ever told us about this. And they had tried to contact NUMMI Financial. So what we're seeing is just kind of this massive fleecing of really just the most vulnerable parts of society.
Well, Arun, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article from our website later. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, and Salon. He writes regularly at Telesur English. He was a founding editor of the Occupy Wall Street Journal, and he's a correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. His article in The Nation magazine is entitled The Financial Firm That Cornered the Market on Jails. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Now that Hillary Clinton is the Democratic Party nominee for president, and a majority of Bernie Sanders supporters seem to be throwing their weight behind her, it seems to have freed the party from paying lip service to progressive values once more. News reports point out that Clinton and the party are in a fundraising frenzy, turning to their friends on Wall Street and the fossil fuel industry. But not everyone is aligning behind Clinton, despite the specter of Donald Trump. Third-party candidates Jill Stein and Gary Johnson have jumped in the polls. Progressives in particular, however, fear that Stein will play spoiler in the November election and hand Trump a victory by siphoning off too many votes away from Clinton in swing states. The claim that Ralph Nader's Green Party presidential bid in 2000 handed George W. Bush a win over Al Gore is particularly persistent. My guest is Kevin Zeese. He's the co-director of It's Our Economy and an organizer with PopularResistance.org. Zeese was a spokesperson for Ralph Nader in 2004, and he just co-wrote a piece with Margaret Flowers about this issue. Welcome to the program, Kevin.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about the claims themselves. This is just a very, very common theme. People are very angry at those who say they will never vote for Hillary Clinton and they're going to vote for Jill Stein. And the Gore-Bush election is very much in people's minds. What, as far as you can tell, are the claims? What did they base this claim that it was Nader's fault that Bush won in 2000?
Well, it's a very simplistic and false claim, but one of the most effective propaganda efforts by the Democratic Party in the 21st century. It persists despite the facts. The claim is that Gore lost by under 600 votes, Ralph Nader won 97,000 votes, therefore Nader stole the election from Gore. But there's lots of problems with that. First off, the reason that Gore lost the election, let's just be very clear right from the beginning. He lost 300,000 Democratic registered voters to George Bush. He lost over 200,000 progressive, self-described liberal votes to George Bush. If he can't win that base of liberals and Democrats, he lost the election to George Bush. You know, Nader only got about 30,000 votes in each of those categories of liberals and Democrats. Bush got hundreds of thousands. Bush defeated him with a little help, of course, from Scalia and Thomas. On top of that, it's important to remember that if Gore had won his home state of Tennessee, Florida would be irrelevant. If Gore had won the home state of Bill Clinton, Florida would have been irrelevant. And so this concoction that, you know, they don't want to face up to losing 300,000 Democrats to George Bush, 200,000 liberals to George Bush. Instead, they want to focus on Nader's 25, 30,000 votes in those categories. It's just absurd.
Let's look at what Ben Jealous said in an interview on Democracy Now! And you cite this in your article. And because in the end, it seems like it did, of course, come down to Florida during the actual election. If we set aside the fact that Gore should have won the two states that you mentioned and focus on Florida, according to Ben Jealous, George W. Bush got into the White House because Al Gore lost by about 900 votes in Florida. Ralph Nader got 90,000. The reports, the studies that went back and looked of those voters said 60% of them would have gone for Gore if Nader wasn't on the ballot there. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, that's Ben Jealous, of course, worked for the NAACP, which is basically an arm of the Democratic Party. And Ben Jealous is an apologist for Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party. So just first off, let's start with his bias and get that out in the open. Second, what's wrong with that is that CNN did an exit poll the day of the election in 2000. And the election poll found that Nader took equal number of votes from Republican voters and Democratic voters, the registered voters voted for him, and that if he had not been in the race, Gore would have lost by more, by 2%. And why is that? Because a lot of the voters who came out and voted when Nader was on the ballot would not have bothered to vote for either Gore or for Bush. You know, about hundreds of thousands of Democrats stayed home that day rather than come out and vote for Al Gore. If 1% of the people who stayed home, if 1% of the Democrats or 1% of the liberals who voted for George Bush had voted for Al Gore, he would have been president. So he lost his base. Why go out of your way to blame Nader? I'll tell you why they do it. They go out of their way to blame Nader because they don't want to face the real reality. The Democrats don't want to face the real reality. That someone who had a history, Al Gore, of corporatism and militarism supporting every war back to Vietnam was not a very popular position compared to someone who was running as, I'm not saying he was, but he was running as a compassionate conservative who did not believe in nation building. And so a corporate militarist versus a compassionate conservative who didn't believe in nation building, George Bush beat that. It was a more popular position to take, even among Democrats, even among liberals, and it convinced many of Democrats to stay home and not even bother voting for Al Gore. So that's the election about. They don't want to face that because their money comes from Wall Street. Their money comes from big business. And if they face the reality that corporate militarism is not the way to run for president, that has to make them rethink everything. The Democrats have to then go back to their funders and realize taking money from Wall Street, taking money from big business, taking money from weapons makers actually does not work politically. It's not a good trade-off.
We have to remember the 2000 election, of course, happened when George W. Bush was a relatively blank slate. I mean, he'd been governor of Texas, but this was before the September 11th attacks, of course. He was president for only about a year, less than a year, really, when the September 11th attacks happened. And then we see history judging G.W. Bush by those actions that came. But at the time during the election, I had not heard these statistics that hundreds of thousands of Democrats and, non-Democrat liberals had ended up voting for George W. Bush, which is pretty remarkable. In fact, I remember hearing that Arabs and Arab Americans were voting more Republican than Democrat. All of that changed after the September 11th attacks.
That's right. And the Muslims and Arabs are a very good point, because we've talked to Muslim political activists, and they said that when in 2000, when they contacted the Bush campaign, they got a response. Someone high up in the Bush campaign would get back to them. If they couldn't get George Bush to an event, they would get a high-level person to an event. When they contacted the Gore campaign, they ignored them. The Democrats didn't call back. The Gore campaign didn't call back. And so they felt dissed, by the Gore campaign, and they went to the Bush campaign. That's one of the problems with Al Gore's campaign. He had a lot of hubris. He had a lot of he's better than anyone else, knows better than anybody else. He can do this without anyone's help. He ran away from Bill Clinton, who was at 65% in the polls at the time. He was a very popular president. The economy was going well. There were lots of reasons he could have run differently. Then he picked, as possibly the worst vice presidential choice, Joe Lieberman, one of the more conservative Democrats. He essentially was the senator for insurance industry. He came from Connecticut. And he was one of the most aggressive militarists and aggressive supporters of Israeli Zionism. So he was a very unpopular choice. So that just added to Gore's history of being a corporate militarist. And so it was a very poorly run campaign. And for them to look around to find a scapegoat, and you know, if you want to blame things, you could blame the weather. It was too hot that day to go vote. I didn't want to go vote. It was too hot. You could blame the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach, which actually did cause a lot of missed votes, because the Palm Beach butterfly ballot, there were people who were intended to vote for Gore because the ballot was so messed up, they voted for Pat Buchanan just because of the way the ballot was set up. So that was a legitimate concern. There were also many blacks stopped from going to vote. There were roadblocks in black communities. There was a concerted effort to keep blacks from voting. So there's lots of reasons to criticize the Florida election. But the bottom line is Gore lost hundreds of thousands of votes to liberals and to Democrats, to George Bush. And that's the real reason. Everything else is fake. Because they didn't learn that lesson, that corporate militarism is a lousy way to run a campaign, they then picked John Kerry, who also lost. He couldn't even beat George Bush after he was so unpopular. Obama was able to get around it because he's African-American. He's got great rhetoric. He also had very much a blank slate. He was a new senator. And so, like George Bush in 2000, Obama could make his own picture on it, on his slate, and define himself the way he wants to. So he defined himself as anti-war, anti-the Iraq war, and he also defined himself as a populist, you know, talking about health care and those kinds of issues. So Obama was able to overcome that because he had no record to run on. Hillary Clinton right now should be, you know, landsliding Donald Trump, because she is so disliked, and she's disliked because of her history. Her history of supporting trade agreements, you know, being part of the destruction of the social safety net, being in favor of Wall Street, and being in favor of every war that's ever come before her. She also is a corporate militarist, and she's very unpopular. And she's probably going to win because Donald Trump is insane, and, you know, his racism and his bigotry and his picking fights with everybody, you know, is just not a good way to run a presidential campaign. So she's probably going to win easily in the Electoral College. The demographics of the United States have changed so much, more Latino, less white male voters. The demographics are going the Democrat Party way. So I think she's going to win an easy victory, despite her really being so disliked by so many voters.
Right. In fact, Kevin, there was a New York Times statistical analysis that found that just a few, you know, less than 20% of the eligible voting public in the U.S. voted in the primary elections for either Trump or Clinton. And then if you just look at the percentage of the population as a whole, it was 9%. So two of these highly unpopular candidates running against one another. And of course, what's going to either end up happening is a lot of people are going to stay at home because they just can't bear to cast their votes, or they're going to throw their vote behind Hillary Clinton as a lesser of two evils choice, or they're going to go for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein. Now, let's talk about this.
That's
talk about applying the 2000 story to the 2016 story. 16 years later, we're told Stein is going to play the Nader effect. And, you know, somehow Gary Johnson doesn't get the same treatment. How do you respond to this standard argument?
Well, basically, there's two myths that the Democrats are running on. One is the Nader myth, which we've talked about. The other is the fear of Trump myth. And I call it a myth because if you look at all the election prognostications, and 538, you know, does a good compilation of all the polls and breaks it down by state and then does an analysis of the Electoral College. It's about a 70% chance that Hillary Clinton wins the Electoral College, a 30% chance for Trump. So he's almost out of it already, and that number is getting worse and worse every day for Trump. I don't know if he's going to reverse it or not, but he's been just running a terrible campaign. Now, what's different than this year than that one, Gary Johnson is more likely to get the most votes of a third party just because Trump is so hated.
By the own Republican Party base, he's hated.
Oh, my gosh, it's amazing. Every day, Republicans are leaving him. Every day, Republican donors are leaving him. Republican thinkers in the neocon world are going to Hillary Clinton. Every day, you see that shift from Republican funders, donors, politicians, thinkers, writers, all George Will, all going toward Hillary Clinton. It's just an incredible thing. And so, but so Johnson's going to pick up some support from that, because a lot of these Republicans don't want to go to Hillary, but they want to vote against Trump, and they don't want to vote for Hillary. So Johnson's the logical choice for a Republican, since he's a small government, low tax, pro-business kind of guy. He's even pro-Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is so insane that I can't imagine anyone voting for him. But anyway, he's favored TPP. Jill Stein is running a great campaign. She was the earliest Green ever to get matching funds, and they only get that during the primaries. So she's got a lot of money to spend between now and the end of the Green convention. So there'll be some an advertising campaign, which is unheard of in Green politics, because we run with, you know, just people's money, and haven't had the success of Bernie Sanders in doing that. And she has a really strong vice presidential candidate, Ajamu Baraka, who is a great human rights activist, has been a human rights leader for many years. He comes from a black, radical black analysis, which I think is so needed in this debate. He's the only African-American running out of eight president and vice presidential candidates in national campaigns. So that's a great team. And they're putting forth a great message that's very popular with voters. The question is, can they overcome the fear of Trump? And it may happen that as the election gets closer and this fear of Trump becomes more obvious a myth, that the Nader myth will have no impact and people will recognize they really have the freedom to vote for what they want. That's a rarity in the United States. Most people in the United States hold their nose and vote. They don't get to vote for candidates they want. They get forced between two oligarch candidates, two elite candidates. That's all we ever get to choose from, except for the third parties. This year is an unusual year because Trump is such a poor candidate that people really have the freedom to vote for what they want. So this should be a very good year for both the Greens and libertarians. I think the key is for people to work for is to get them into the debates. That is the most important thing. We need to have those voices out there. We don't want a two-way debate between Trump and Clinton. That's going to be like useless for the body politic to learn anything new, to think about any new issues. If you get Johnson and Stein in there and their VPs, that would be a fantastic debate that would really open up the political culture to a lot of new ideas. So that would be a great thing, I think, for the country.
Kevin, I want to talk about Sanders' candidacy, because this, you know, sure. When Sanders ran for the primary election and just electrified so many people around the country, seemed to obviously touch a serious nerve in the country. Do you think that he politicized people who ordinarily wouldn't vote in elections, and then for Clinton supporters to turn around and expect all of those same people that he energized and activated to simply hand their vote over to her? You know, that just seems like an unlikely scenario. Either those people who would never have gotten involved in the election, either they end up voting for Jill Stein or for nobody at all, right? I mean, it's not like she and the establishment Democrat ever had those votes to begin with. Is that accurate, you think?
I think that's for a large chunk of those voters.
Right, not
true.
For all, you know, Bernie Sanders supporters, of course.
That's right. The Bernie Sanders supporters, a lot of those Bernie Sanders supporters were Democrats. Right. People vote Democrat. And traditionally, when you have an insurgent candidate like Sanders or Kucinich or Jesse Jackson or Howard Dean, first off, the primary system for the Democrats is so rigged that they never win. All they can do is energize a base and keep that base in the Democratic Party if they're, you know, traditional Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so that meant that.
But Sanders came closer than any of those other people you mentioned. 46% of pledged delegates at the convention were for him.
85 to 90% of those kind of voters, though, do stay with the Democrats traditionally. Now, I think Sanders is different. He did run the most effective insurgent campaign in decades. I can't think of the most recent one that did better. The key thing was he was able to raise money in small donations, because one of the key ways they rig the primaries is they have these Super Tuesdays, multiple big states all over the country at once. Then all of March is March Madness, when you have two dozen states voting or having caucuses in 1 month. And for a campaign with no money, which most insurgents have no money, that's an impossible task. You can't compete unless you can go on the air with advertising. Sanders was able to beat that. He was able to raise enough money to run a legitimate campaign against this rigged approach of joining all these states together, making it very hard for us. So he ran a great campaign. Now, will people follow him, his lead to Hillary? It depends. I mean, some people look at Sanders and say, he's my leader, I'm going to follow him. Other people say, I think for myself. And I was turned on by Sanders, but I'm not turned on by Hillary. and I'm going to stay away, and I'm looking for an alternative, and I may vote for Jill Stein. Some may vote for Gary Johnson in a bizarre way. Some may vote for even Trump in a bizarre way. I can't imagine what they're thinking, but somehow they're thinking that. But Jill Stein is certainly the one that should get their vote. She is the most consistent with Sanders, and she was very friendly to Sanders during the campaign, reaching out to him constantly, applauding his voters constantly, even talking to one of his main spokespersons, Nina Turner, about being her vice president. So she had a big outreach to the Sanders base. And so I think she could benefit from that. And I think that was a smart political move on her part, to be very open to them and not to be so, you know, stringent in just supporting green perspectives and not very, very progressive socialist perspectives.
Well, Kevin, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We'll post a link to your article about the Nader issue from our website later today. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Kevin Zeese is the co-director of It's Our Economy and an organizer with PopularResistance.org. He was a spokesperson for Ralph Nader in 2004. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Kits Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
The time now is 7 p.m. It's Friday. You're tuned in to KBOO Portland. We have Hard Knock Radio. We have some announcements. And then at 8 p.m., we have 1212. I have 2 hours of hip-hop planned for you guys. So here we go. Some promos, some happenings.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th, 2016 at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds in Salem. For the first time ever, Oregon's producers will be able to display live plants at the